The committee will be in order. President Trump's pressure campaign against state officials existed in all the key battleground states that he lost. But the former president had a particular obsession with Georgia. Here is the president on the afternoon of January 6th, after his own attorney general warned him that the claims you are about to hear are patently false.
They should find those votes. They should absolutely find that. Just over 11,000 votes, that's all we need. They defrauded us out of a win in Georgia, and we're not going to forget it.
So the state of Georgia is where we will turn our attention to next. I want to emphasize that our investigation into these issues is still ongoing. As I stated in our last hearing, if you have relevant information or documentary evidence to share with the Select Committee, we welcome your cooperation. But we will share some of our findings with you today. Secretary Ratzenberger, thank you for being here today. You've been a public servant in Georgia since 2015, serving first as a member of the Georgia House of Representatives, and then since January 2019, as Georgia's Secretary of State. As a self-described conservative Republican, is it fair to say that you wanted President Trump to win the 2020 election?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Secretary, many witnesses have told the Select Committee that Election Day, November 3rd, 2020, was a largely uneventful day in their home states. In spite of the challenges of conducting an election during a pandemic, you wrote in the Washington Post that the election was, quote, successful. Tell us, what was your impression of how Election Day had proceeded in Georgia?
On Election Day in November, our election went remarkably smooth. In fact, we meet at the GEMA headquarters, that's the Georgia Energy Emergency Management Association meeting location, but we are following wait times in line. In the afternoon, our average wait time was 3 minutes statewide that we were recording for various precincts, and it actually got down to 2 minutes. And at the end of the day, we felt that we had a successful election from the standpoint of the administration and the operation of the election.
Thank you. The chair recognizes the gentleman from California, Mr. Schiff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary Ratzenberger, did Joe Biden win the 2020 presidential election in Georgia, and by what margin?
President Biden carried the state of Georgia by approximately 12,000 votes.
And Mr. Secretary, as I understand it, your office took several steps to ensure the accuracy of the vote count in Georgia, reviewing the vote count in at least three different ways. These steps included a machine recount, a forensic audit, and a full hand recount of every one of the 5 million ballots cast. Did these efforts, including a recount of literally every ballot cast in the state of Georgia, confirm the result?
Yes, they did. We counted the ballots where the first tabulation would be scanned. Then when we did our 100% hand audit of the entire, all 5 million ballots in the state of Georgia, all cast in place, all absentee ballots, they were all hand recounted and they came remarkably close to the first count. And then upon the election being certified, President Trump, because he was within 0.5%, could ask for a recount. And then we recounted him again through the scanners and we got remarkably the same count. Three counts, all remarkably close, which showed that President Trump did come up short.
Nevertheless, as you will see, the president and his allies began making numerous false allegations of voter fraud, false allegations that you and Mr. Sterling, among others, had to address. Mr. Sterling, thank you also for being here today. Following the 2020 election, in addition to your normal duties, I understand that you became a spokesperson to try to combat disinformation about the election and the danger it was creating for elections officials, among others. In a December 1 press conference, you addressed some of your remarks directly to President Trump. Let's take a look at what you said that day.
Mr. President, it looks like you likely lost the state of Georgia. We're investigating. There's always a possibility. I get it. And you have the rights to go through the courts. What you don't have the ability to do, and you need to step up and say this, is stop inspiring people to commit potential acts of violence. Someone's going to get hurt. Someone's going to get shot. Someone's going to get killed. And it's not right. It's not right.
Mr. Sterling, what prompted you to make these remarks?
Mr. Schiff, we had had a previously scheduled press conference that day, as we were in the habit of doing, trying to be as transparent as we could about the election and the counts going on. A little after lunch that day, lunchtime, I received a call from the project manager from Dominion Voting Systems, who was oddly audibly shaken. She's not the kind of person I would assume would be that way. She has a master's from MIT, a graduate of the Naval Academy, and is very much on the ball and pretty unflappable. And she informed me about a young contractor they had who had been receiving threats from a video had been posted by some QAnon supporters. And at that point, we had been sort of been steeping in this kind of stuff. So it was around us all the time, so I didn't take note of it more than adding to the pile of other stuff we were having to deal with. And I did pull up Twitter, and I scrolled through it, and I saw the young man's name. It was a particular tweet that, for lack of a better word, was a straw that broke the camel's back. Had the young man's name. It was a very unique name. I believe he was a first-generation American. And said, had his name. You committed treason. May God have mercy on your soul, with a slowly twisting gif of a noose. And for lack of a better word, I lost it. I just got irate. My boss was with me at the time, the Deputy Secretary Jordan Fuchs, and she could tell that I was angry. I tend to turn red from here up when that happens, and that happened at that time. And she called Secretary Raffensperger to say, we're seeing these kind of threats, and Gabe thinks we need to say something about it. And Secretary said yes, and that's what prompted me to do what I did. I lost my temper, but it seemed necessary at the time because it was just getting worse. And I could not tell you why that particular one was the one that put me over the edge, but it did.
Now, after you made this plea to the president, did Donald Trump urge his supporters to avoid the use of violence?
Not to my knowledge.
Now, as we know, the president was aware of your speech because he tweeted about it later that day. Let's take a look at what the president said. In the tweet, Donald Trump claims that there was, quote, massive voter fraud in Georgia. Mr. Sterling, that was just plain false, wasn't it?
Yes, sir.
Nevertheless, the very next day, on December 2nd, President Trump released a lengthy video again making false claims of election fraud in Georgia. Let's take a look at what he said this time.
They found thousands and thousands of votes that were out of whack, all against me.
In fact, the day after Donald Trump released that video, so now we're talking just 2 days after the emotional warning that you gave that someone's going to get killed, representatives of President Trump appeared in Georgia, including Rudy Giuliani, and launched a new conspiracy theory that would take on a life of its own and threaten the lives of several innocent election workers. This story falsely alleges that sometime during election night, election workers at the State Farm Arena in Atlanta, Georgia, kicked out poll observers. After the observers left, the story goes, these workers pulled so-called suitcases of ballots from under a table and ran those ballots through counting machines multiple times. Completely without evidence, President Trump and his allies claimed that these suitcases contained as many as 18,000 ballots, all for Joe Biden. None of this was true. But Rudy Giuliani appeared before the Georgia State Senate and played a surveillance video from State Farm Arena, falsely claiming that it showed this conspiracy taking place. Here's a sample of what Mr. Giuliani had to say during that hearing.
And when you look at what you saw on the video, which to me was a smoking gun, powerful smoking gun, well, I don't have to be a genius to figure out what happened. And I don't have to be a genius to figure out that those votes are not legitimate votes. You don't put legitimate votes under a table.
No.
Wait until you throw the opposition out and in the middle of the night count them. We would have to be fools to think that.
President Trump's campaign amplified Giuliani's false testimony in a tweet pushing out the video footage. Giuliani likewise pushed out his testimony on social media. As you can see in this tweet, Mr. Giuliani wrote that it was, quote, now beyond doubt, unquote, that Fulton County Democrats had stolen the election. Later in this hearing, we'll hear directly from one of the election workers in this video about the effect these lies had on her and on her family. Mr. Sterling, did the investigators in your office review the entire surveillance tape from the State Farm Arena on election night?
They actually reviewed approximately 48 hours going over the time period where action was taking place at the counting center at State Farm Arena.
And what did the tape actually show?
Depending on which time you want to start, because as was mentioned, this conspiracy theory took on a life of its own, where they conflated a water main break that wasn't a water main break and throwing observers out and a series of other things. What it actually showed was Fulton County election workers engaging in normal ballot processing. One of the things that was very frustrating was the so-called suitcases of ballots from under the table. If you watch the entirety of the video, you saw that these were election workers who were under the impression they were going to get to go home around 10, 10:30. People are putting on their coats. They're putting ballots that are prepared to be scanned into ballot carriers that are then sealed with tamper-proof seals so that they're not messed with. It's an interesting thing because you watch there's four screens of the video, and as you're watching it, you can see the election monitors in the corner with the press as they're taking these ballot carriers and putting them under the table. You see it there. One of the other hidden ones, if you looked at the actual tape, was on the outside of the table just from the camera angle. You couldn't see it originally. And this goes under the no good deed goes unpunished. We were told that we were at GEMA, as the secretary pointed out, and we were told that it looked like they were shutting down the Fulton County counting. The secretary expressed some displeasure at that because we wanted to everybody keep counting so we could get to the results and know what was happening. So our elections director called their elections director, who was at another location because this was election day. There was two different places where ballot things were being done by the Fulton County office. So he called the elections director from Fulton, then called Ralph Jones, who was at the State Farm Arena, and said, what the heck are you doing? Go ahead and stay. And as you watch the video itself, you see him take the phone call as people are putting things away and getting ready to leave. And you can tell for about 15, 20 seconds, he does not want to tell these people they have to stay. He walks over, he thinks about it for a second, you see him come back to the corner of a desk and kind of slumps his shoulders and says, okay, y'all, we got to keep on counting. And then you see him take their coats off, get the ballots out. And then a secondary thing that you'll see on there is you'll have people who are counting ballots who a batch will go through, they will take them off and run that through again. What happens there is a standard operating procedure that if there is a misscan, if there's a misalignment, if it doesn't read right, these are high speed, high capacity scanners. So three or four will go through after a misscan. You have to delete that batch and put it back through again. And by going through the hand tally, as the secretary pointed out, we showed that if there had been multiple ballots scanned without a corresponding physical ballot, your counts would have been a lot higher than the ballots themselves. And by doing the hand tally, we saw two specific numbers that were met. The hand tally got us to a 0.1053% off of the total votes cast and 0.0099% on the margin, which is essentially dead on accurate. Most academic studies say on a hand tally you'll have between 1% and 2%, but because we use ballot marking devices where it's very clear what the voter intended, it made it a lot easier for us to conduct that hand count and show that none of that was true.
Now, I understand that when you reviewed these tapes and did the analysis, it disproved this conspiracy theory. But you still had to take a lot of steps to try to make sure the public knew the truth about these allegations. And you did frequent briefings for the press. Let's take a look at one of those press briefings, Mr. Sterling, that you held on December 7th. To make the point that you just did today.
Move on to what I'm going to call Disinformation Monday. Out of the gate, many of y'all saw the videotape from State Farm Arena. I spent hours with our post-certified investigators, Justin Gray from WSB, spent hours with us going over this video to explain to people that what you saw, the secret suitcases with magic ballots, were actually ballots that had been packed into those absentee ballot carriers by the workers in plain view of the monitors and the press. And what's really frustrating is the president's attorneys had this same videotape.
They saw the exact same things the rest of us could see, and they chose to mislead state senators and the public about what was on that video. I'm quite sure that they will not characterize the video if they try to enter into evidence, because that is the kind of thing that could lead to sanctions, because it's obviously untrue. They knew it was untrue, and they continue to do things like this.
Mr. Sterling, despite the efforts by your office to combat this misinformation by speaking out publicly and through local media, you were unable to match the reach of President Trump's platform and social media megaphone spreading these false conspiracy theories. What was it like to compete with a president who had the biggest bully pulpit in the world to push out these false claims?
For lack of a better word, it was frustrating. But oftentimes I felt our information was getting out, but that there was a reticence of people who needed to believe it because the President of the United States, whom many looked up to and respected, was telling them it wasn't true. Despite the facts, and I characterized at one point, it was kind of like a shovel trying to empty the ocean. And yes, it was frustrating. I even have, you know, family members who I had to argue with about some of these things, and I would show them things. And the problem you have is you're getting to people's hearts. I remember there's one specific, an attorney that we know that we showed and walked him through. This wasn't true. Okay, I get that. This wasn't true. Okay, I get that. This wasn't five or six things. But at the end, he goes, I just know in my heart they cheated. That's just, and so once you get past the heart, the facts don't matter as much. And our job, from our point of view, is to get the facts out, do our job, tell the truth, follow the Constitution, follow the law, and defend the institutions and the institutions held.
Let's take a look at what you were competing with. This is the former president speaking in Georgia on December 5th.
Evidence of fraud is overwhelming. And again, I'm going to ask you to look up at that very, very powerful and very expensive screen.
Hidden cases of possible ballots are rolled out from under a table. Four people under a cloud of suspicion.
So if you just take the crime of what those Democrat workers were doing. And by the way, there was no water main break. You know, they said there was no water main break. That's 10 times more than I need to win this state. 10 times more. It's 10 times, maybe more than that, but it's 10 times more because we lost by a very close number.
In this committee's hearing last Monday, we heard from senior federal law enforcement officials, from the senior-most federal law enforcement official in Atlanta at the time, U.S. Attorney for the Northern District, B.J. Pack, as well as former Attorney General Bill Barr. They both testified that the allegations were thoroughly investigated and found to have no merit. Here is U.S. Attorney Pack.
They go to Attorney General Barr. I told him that we looked into it. We've done several things, including interviewing the witnesses. I listened to the tapes and review the videotape myself, and that there was nothing there. Giuliani was wrong in representing that this was a suitcase full of ballots.
And here's what Attorney General Bill Barr had to say about the same allegations.
Took a look, hard look at this ourselves, and based on our review of it, including the interviews of the key witnesses, the Fulton County allegations had no merit.
We also have testimony from senior Department of Justice officials establishing that they specifically told President Trump that these allegations had been thoroughly investigated and were completely without merit. Here is Acting Attorney, Deputy Attorney General Richard Donahue describing a phone conversation in which he specifically told President Trump that these allegations were false.
And kept fixating on this suitcase that supposedly had fraudulent ballots and that the suitcase was rolled out from under the table. And I said, no, sir, there is no suitcase. You can watch that video over and over. There is no suitcase. There is a wheeled bin where they kept.
Where they carry the ballots. No matter how many times senior Department of Justice officials, including his own attorney general, told the president that these allegations were not true, President Trump kept promoting these lies and putting pressure on state officials to accept them. On January 2nd, the The president had a lengthy telephone conversation with Secretary Raffensperger. Prior to the president's call, though, I want to share a bit of important context. First, the White House, including the former president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, repeatedly called or texted the secretary's office some 18 times in order to set up this call. They were quite persistent. Second, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows took the extraordinary step of showing up at a signature audit site in Georgia, where he met with Secretary Raffensperger's chief investigator, Francis Watson, who was supervising that audit process. Behind me is a photograph from that visit. Third, the day after Meadows' Georgia visit, he set up a call between President Trump and Francis Watson. On the call between President Trump and Georgia investigator Francis Watson, the former president continued to push the false claim that he'd won the state of Georgia. Let's listen to that part of the conversation.
You know, it's just you have the most important job in the country right now, because if we win Georgia, first of all, if we win, you're going to have two wins. So they're not going to win right now. You know, they're down because the people of Georgia are so angry at what happened to me. They know I won by hundreds of thousands of votes. It wasn't close.
And in this next clip, he told the state law enforcement official that she be praised if she found the right answer.
Hopefully, I will. When the right answer comes out, you'll be praised. I mean, I don't know why, you know, they made it so hard. They will be praised. People will say, great, because that's what it's about, that ability to check and to make it right. Because everyone knows it's wrong. There's just no way.
Mr. Raffensperger, I know you weren't on this call, but that you have listened to it. President Trump didn't win by hundreds of thousands of votes in Georgia, did he?
No, he did not. I've been traveling through the state of Georgia for a year now, and simply put, in a nutshell, what happened in fall of 2020 is that 28,000 Georgians skipped the presidential race, and yet they voted down ballot in other races. And the Republican congressman ended up getting 33,000 more votes than President Trump. And that's why President Trump came up short.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. The president on this call doesn't stop here. Let's listen to another part of the conversation between President Trump and Ms. Watson.
Anyway, but whatever you can do, Francis, it would be, it's a great thing. It's an important thing for the country. So important. You have no idea it's so important.
Well,
and I very much appreciate it.
Whatever you can do, Francis. This is the President of the United States calling an investigator looking into the election in which he is a candidate and asking her to do whatever you can do. Mr. Secretary, he placed this call to your chief investigator on September 23rd, 2020. The Select Committee has received text messages indicating that Mark Meadows wanted to send some of the investigators in her office, in the words of one White House aide, a shitload of POTUS stuff, including coins, actual autographed MAGA hats, etc. White House staff intervened to make sure that didn't happen. It was clear at the time of this call that the former president had his sights set on January 6th. Listen to this portion when he told Francis Watson about a very important date.
Do you think they'll be working after Christmas and keep it going fast? Because, you know, we have that date of the 6th, which is a very important date.
That important date, of course, was the joint session of Congress, where Georgia's electoral votes would be counted for Joe Biden. A little over a week after this call to Francis Watson, the president was finally able to speak with you, Secretary Raffensperger. Bear in mind, as we discuss this call today, that by this point in time, early January, the election in Georgia had already been certified. But perhaps more important, the president of the United States had already been told repeatedly by his own top Justice Department officials that the claims he was about to make to you about massive fraud in Georgia were completely false. Mr. Secretary, the call between you and the president lasted 67 minutes, over an hour. We obviously can't listen to the entire recording here today, although it is available on the Select Committee's website. But we'll listen to selected excerpts of it now so that we can get your insights. Let's begin with the president raising the thoroughly debunked allegations of suitcases of ballots.
And
in an official voter box. They were in what looked to be suitcases or trunks, suitcases, but they weren't in in voter boxes. The minimum number it could be, because we watched it and they watched it certified in slow motion, instant replay, if you can believe it, but had slow motion and it was magnified many times over. And the minimum it was 18,000 ballots, all for Biden.
These are the allegations that the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and your office had all said were false. Is that right?
Correct. And even more importantly, when B.J. Pack resigned as U.S. Attorney of the Northern District, President Trump appointed as acting U.S. Attorney of the Northern District Bobby Christine. And Bobby Christine looked at that, and he was quoted in the AJC, that he found nothing, and he dismissed that case early on.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. The President references suitcases or trunks. Mr. Sterling, were the objects seen in these videos suitcases or trunks, or were they just the ordinary containers that are used by election workers?
They're standard ballot carriers that allow for seals to be put on them so they're tamper-proof.
And finally, the President claims that there was a minimum of 18,000 ballots somehow smuggled in, all for Biden. I take it, gentlemen, that was also categorically false?
There's no physical way he can know who those ballots were for, but secondarily, we had Fulton County for years has been an issue in our state when it comes to elections. So they had a very difficult time during the primary, in large part because of COVID. So we had put them under a consent decree, the secretary got negotiated, where we had a monitor on site. And his name is Carter Jones, and he took a notation. He had gone from State Farm to the English Street warehouse to look at election day activities, but before he left the State Farm arena, he noted how many ballots had been counted on each one of the machines. And when he came back after we found out they were working again, he took note again when they closed. And I believe the final number was something around 8,900 total ballots were scanned from the time he left to the time about 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning, so way below 18,000.
Let's play the next clip.
I heard it was close. I said, there's no way. But they dropped a lot of votes in there late at night. You know that, Brett.
Mr. Secretary, did somebody drop a lot of votes there late at night?
No. I believe that the President was referring to some of the counties when they would upload, but the ballots had all been accepted and had to be accepted by state law by 7 p.m. So there were no additional ballots accepted after 7 p.m.
Let's play the next clip in which the President makes claims about so-called dead voters.
The other thing, dead people. So dead people voted. And I think the number is in the close to 5,000 people. And they went to obituaries. They went to all sorts of methods to come up with an accurate number. And a minimum is close to about 5,000 voters.
Mr. Secretary, did your office investigate whether those allegations were accurate? Did 5,000 dead people in Georgia vote?
No, it's not accurate. And actually, in their lawsuits, they alleged 10,315 dead people. We found two dead people when I wrote my letter to Congress that stated January 6th. And subsequent to that, we found two more. That's 4 people, not 4,000, but just a total of 4, not 10,000, not 5,000.
Let's play the next clip.
And there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated, because the 2,236 and absentee ballots, I mean, they're all exact numbers that were done by accounting firms, law firms, etc. And even if you cut them in half, cut them in half, and cut them in half again, it's more votes than we need.
Mr. Secretary, is there any way that you could have lawfully changed the result in the state of Georgia and somehow explained it away as a recalculation?
No, the numbers are the numbers. The numbers don't lie. We had many allegations, and we investigated every single one of them. In fact, I challenged my team, did we miss anything? They said that there was over 66,000 underage voters. We found that there was actually zero. You can register to vote in Georgia. When you're 17 and a half, you have to be 18 by election day. We checked that out, every single voter. They said that there was 2,423 non-registered voters. There were zero. They said that there was 2,056 felons. We identified less than 74 or less that were actually still on felony sentence. every single allegation. We checked. We ran down the rabbit trail to make sure that our numbers were accurate.
So there's no way you could have recalculated it except by fudging the numbers?
The numbers were the numbers, and we could not recalculate because we had made sure that we had checked every single allegation. And we had many investigations. We had nearly 300 from the 2020 election.
Mr. Secretary, you tried to push back when the president made these unsupported claims, whether they were about suitcases of ballots or that Biden votes were counted three times. Let's play the next clip.
President, they did not put that. We did an audit of that, and we proved conclusively that they were not scanned three times. Yeah, Mr. President, we'll send you the link from WSB that doesn't.
I don't care about a link. I don't need it. I have a much better link.
You told the president you would send him a link from WSB, which I understand is a local television station that had an unedited video from the State Farm Arena. But the president wasn't interested in that. He said he had a much better link. Mr. Secretary, at the time that you were on the call with the president, as we have shown, both the FBI and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation had proven these claims to be nonsense. And you told him about these investigations on the phone. Let's listen to what President Trump had to say about the state and federal law enforcement officers who investigated these false claims.
There's no way they could find. Then they're incompetent. They're either dishonest
or
incompetent, okay? There's only two answers, dishonesty or incompetence. There's just no way. Look, there's no way.
But the president didn't stop at insinuating that law enforcement officers were either dishonest or incompetent. He went on to suggest that you could be subject to criminal liability for your role in the matter. Before I play that portion of the conversation, I'd like to show you something that the president retweeted a couple weeks before your call with him. Here's the president retweeting a post from one of his allies, a lawyer who was later sanctioned by a judge in Michigan for making false claims of election fraud. Let's take a look at that tweet. The tweet read, quote, President Trump, at real Donald Trump, is a genuinely good man. He does not really like to fire people. I bet he dislikes putting people in jail, especially, quote unquote, Republicans. He gave at Brian Kemp, Georgia, and at Georgia Secretary of State every chance to get it right. They refused. They will soon be going to jail. So on your call, this was not the first time the president was suggesting you might be criminally liable. With that, let's listen to this portion of the call.
I think you're going to find that they are shredding ballots because they have to get rid of the ballots because the ballots are unsigned, the ballots are corrupt, and they're brand new, and they don't have seals, and there's a whole thing with the ballots, but the ballots are corrupt, and you're going to find that they are, which is totally illegal. It's more illegal for you than it is for them. Because you know what they did, and you're not reporting it. That's a criminal offense, and you know you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk.
Secretary Raffensperger, after making a false claim about shredding of ballots, the president suggested that you may be committing a crime by not going along with his claims of election fraud. And after suggesting that you might have criminal exposure, President Trump makes his most explicit ask of the call. Let's play a part of that conversation.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
Mr. Secretary, was the president here asking you for exactly what he wanted? One more vote than his opponent.
What I knew is that we didn't have any votes to find. We had continued to look. We investigated, like I just shared the numbers with you. There were no votes to find. That was an accurate count that had been certified. And as our general counsel said, there was no shredding of ballots.
Mr. Secretary, after making this request, the president then goes back to the danger of having you deny these allegations of fraud. Let's listen to that part of the clip.
And I watched you this morning, and you said, well, there was no criminality. But I mean, all of this stuff is very dangerous stuff. When you talk about no criminality, I think it's very dangerous. for you to say that.
Secretary Raffensperger, you wrote about this in your book, and you said, quote, "I felt then and still believe today that this was a threat. Others obviously thought so too, because some of Trump's more radical followers have responded as if it was their duty to carry out this threat. Please tell us what you, your wife, even your daughter-in-law experienced regarding threats from Trump's more radical followers."
Well, after the election, my email, my cell phone was doxxed, and so I was getting texts all over the country, and then eventually my wife started getting the text, and hers typically came in as sexualized texts, which were disgusting. You have to understand that Trish and I, we met in high school, and we've been married over 40 years now, and so they started going after her, I think, just to probably put pressure on me, why don't you just quit, walk away. And so that happened, and then some people broke into my daughter-in-law's home, and my son has passed, and she's a widow, and has two kids, and so we're very concerned about her safety also.
And Mr. Secretary, why didn't you just quit and walk away?
Because I knew that we had followed the law and we had followed the Constitution. And I think sometimes moments require you to stand up and just take the shots when you're doing your job. And that's all we did. You know, we just followed the law and we followed the Constitution. And at the end of the day, President Trump came up short. But I had to be faithful to the Constitution. And that's what I swore an oath to do.
During the remainder of the call, the former president continued to press you to find the remaining votes that would ensure his victory in Georgia. Let's listen to a little more.
Why wouldn't you want to find the right answer, Brad, instead of keep saying that the numbers are right? So look, can you get together tomorrow? And Brad, we just want the truth. It's simple. And everyone's going to look very good if the truth comes out. It's okay. It takes a little while, but let the truth come out. And the real truth is I won by 400,000 votes, at least. So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
4 days after the president's call to Secretary Raffensperger was January 6th. The president whipped up the crowd in front of the Ellipse, once again promoting the allegation that Secretary Raffensperger, the president's own attorney general, had told him was false. Here he is on the Ellipse.
In Fulton County, Republican poll watchers were ejected, in some cases physically, from the room under the false pretense of a pipe burst, water main burst, everybody leave, which we now know was a total lie. Then election officials pulled boxes, Democrats, and suitcases of ballots out from under a table, you all saw it on television, totally fraudulent, and illegally scanned them for nearly 2 hours, totally unsupervised. Tens of thousands of votes. This act coincided with a mysterious vote dump of up to 100,000 votes for Joe Biden, almost none for Trump. Oh, that sounds fair. That was at 1:34 a.m.
Mr. Secretary, Mr. Sterling, I want to thank you for your service to the state of Georgia and to the country. Speaker Bowers, likewise, I want to thank you for your service to the state of Arizona and to the country. You have served not only your home states, but our nation and our democracy. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Thank you, Mr. Schiff. I thank the witnesses for joining us today. You are now dismissed. I now welcome our final witness this afternoon. Andrea Shea Moss. Ms. Moss worked in the Department of Registration and Elections in Fulton County, Georgia, from 2017 until 2022. In that job, Ms. Moss handled voter applications and absentee ballot requests and also helped to process the vote count for several elections. In December 2020, Ms. Moss and her mother, Ms. Ruby Freeman, became the target of nasty lies spread by President Trump and his allies as they sought to overturn the election results in Georgia. Ms. Moss and her mother, Ms. Freeman, are two of the unsung heroes in this country, doing the hard work of keeping our democracy functioning for every American. Ms. Moss, welcome. Thank you for your service, and I thank you for being here today. I will now swear you in. Please stand. Do you swear or affirm on the penalty of perjury that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Thank you. Please be seated. Let the record reflect that the witness answered in the affirmative. Ms. Moss, thank you very much for being here today. I understand that you are here along with your mother today. Would you like to introduce your mama? Hi, Mom. Ms. Moss, today we'll be asking you about some of the threats that you received following the 2020 election. Since you've been an election worker for over 10 years, I want to ask you, in your decade of service, had you ever experienced threats like these before? Don't be nervous. Just, I understand. So, and I want to make sure that the record reflects that you've done it for quite a while and you never received a threat, and your answer was no. Thank you. Pursuant to Section 5C8 of the House Resolution 503, the chair recognizes the gentleman from California, Mr. Schiff, for questions.
Good afternoon, Ms. Moss. Thank you for being here. I understand that you were employed by the Fulton County Registration and Elections Department for more than 10 years, and I understand that you love that job. Please tell us what made you so fond of the work that you did.
Well, I've always been told by my grandmother how important it is to vote and how people before me, a lot of people, older people in my family, did not have that right. So what I loved most about my job were the older voters. Younger people could usually do everything from their phone or go online, but the older voters like to call, they like to talk to you, they like to get my card, they like to know that every election I'm here. And like even college students, a lot of parents trust in me to make sure their child does not have to drive home. They'll get an absentee ballot, they can vote, and I really found pleasure in that. I liked being the one that, you know, if someone can't navigate my voter page or, you know, they want a new precinct card and they don't have a copy machine or a computer or all of that, I could put it in the mail for them. I was excited always about sending out all the absentee ballots for the elderly, disabled people. I even remember driving to an hospital to give someone her absentee application. That's what I love the most.
So you really enjoyed helping people vote and participate, and that was something, the right to vote that your grandmother taught you was precious.
Yes.
Well, I know the events that we're here to talk about today are incredibly difficult to relive. Your proud service as an election worker took a dramatic turn on the day that Rudy Giuliani publicized a video of you and your mother counting ballots on election night. President Trump, Rudy Giuliani, and others claimed on the basis of this video that you and your mother were somehow involved in a plot to kick out observers, bring suitcases of false ballots for Biden into the arena, and then run them through the machines multiple times. None of that was true, was it?
None of it.
I'd like to show you some of the statements that Rudy Giuliani made in a second hearing before the Georgia state legislators, a week after that video clip from State Farm Arena was first circulated by Mr. Giuliani and President Trump. I want to advise viewers that these statements are completely false and also deeply disturbing.
Tape earlier in the day of Ruby Freeman and Shea Freeman Moss and one other gentleman quite obviously, surreptitiously passing around USB ports as if they're vials of heroin or cocaine. I mean, it's obvious to anyone who's a criminal investigator or prosecutor, they are engaged in surreptitious illegal activity, again, that day. And that's a week ago, and they're still walking around Georgia lying. They should have been questioned already. Their places of work, their homes should have been searched for evidence of ballots, for evidence of USB ports, for evidence of voter fraud.
That video was from Rudy Giuliani's appearance at a Georgia State Senate hearing on December 10. How did you first become aware that Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, was accusing you and your mother of a crime?
I was at work, like always, and the former chief, Mr. Jones, asked me to come to his office. And when I went to his office, the former director, Mr. Barron, was in there, and they showed me a video on their computer. It was just like a very short clip of us working at State Farm, and it had someone on the video like talking over the video, just saying that we were doing things that we weren't supposed to do, just lying throughout the video. And that's when I first found out about it.
And were there social media posts that they showed you responding to those false claims?
Well, when I saw the video, of course, the first thing that I said was like, why? Why are they doing this? What's going on? And they, you know, just told me that Trump and his allies were not satisfied with the outcome of the election, and they were getting a lot of threats and being harassed online, and asked me, you know, have I been receiving anything, and I need to check on my mom. And I told them, I was like, where have they, you know, where have you been getting these threats? I don't believe I have any. And Mr. Jones told me, like, they're attacking his Facebook, and I don't really use Facebook. I have one. So I went to the Facebook app, and I'm just kind of panicky at this point because this has never happened to me, and my mom is involved, and I'm like her only child. So I'm just asking him, like, well, where are the messages? All I see is the feeds. Like, how do you get to the messages? And he said, it's another icon on your phone that says Messenger. And I went to that icon, and it was just a lot of horrible things there.
And those horrible things, did they include threats?
Yes, a lot of threats, wishing death upon me, telling me that, you know, I'll be in jail with my mother, and saying things like, be glad it's 2020 and not 1920. That's, yeah.
Were a lot of these threats and vile comments racist in nature?
A lot of them were racist. A lot of them were just hateful. But yes, sir.
In one of the videos we just watched, Mr. Giuliani accused you and your mother of passing some sort of USB drive to each other. What was your mom actually handing you on that video?
A ginger mint.
It wasn't just Rudy Giuliani. We heard President Trump make these false allegations repeatedly during his call with Secretary Raffensperger. Let's listen to a portion of what he had to say about you and your mother.
We had at least 18,000, that's on tape, we had them counted very painstakingly, 18,000 voters having to do with Ruby Freeman. That's she's a vote scammer, a professional vote scammer and hustler.
Donald Trump attacked you and your mother using her name 18 times on that call. 18 times. Ms. Moss, can you describe what you experienced listening to former President Trump attack you and your mother in a call with the Georgia Secretary of State?
I felt horrible. I felt like it was all my fault. Like, if I would have never decided to be an elections worker, like, I could have on anything else, but that's what I decided to do. And now people are lying and spreading rumors and lies and attacking my mom, my only child, going to my grandmother's house, I'm her only grandchild, and my kid. It's just, I felt so bad. I just felt bad for my mom, and I felt horrible for picking this job and being the one that always wants to help and always there, and never missing not one election. I just felt like it was my fault for putting my family in this situation.
Well, it wasn't your fault. Your mother was kind enough to come speak with us earlier. Let's listen to her story in her words.
My name is Ruby Freeman. I've always believed that when God says that he'll make your name great, but this is not the way it was supposed to be. I could have never imagined the events that followed the presidential election 2020. For my entire professional life, I was Lady Ruby. My community in Georgia, where I was born and lived my whole life, knew me as Lady Ruby. I built my own business around that name, LaRuby's Unique Treasures, a pop-up shop catering to ladies with unique fashions. I wore a shirt that proudly proclaimed that I was, and I am, Lady Ruby. Actually, I had that shirt on. I had that shirt in every color. I wore that shirt on Election Day 2020. I haven't worn it since. And I'll never wear it again. Now I won't even introduce myself by my name anymore. I get nervous when I bump into someone I know in the grocery store who says my name. I'm worried about who's listening. I get nervous when I have to give my name for food orders. I'm always concerned of who's around me. I've lost my name. And I've lost my reputation. I've lost my sense of security. All because a group of people, starting with number 45 and his ally, Rudy Giuliani, decided to scapegoat me and my daughter, Shay, to push their own lies about how the presidential election was stolen.
Ms. Moss, how has this experience of being targeted by the former president and his allies affected your life?
It's turned my life upside down. I no longer give out my business card. I don't transfer calls. I don't want anyone knowing my name. I don't want to go anywhere with my mom because she might yell my name out over the grocery aisle or something. I don't go to the grocery store at all. I haven't been anywhere at all. I've gained about 60 pounds. I just don't do nothing anymore. I don't want to go anywhere. I second guess everything that I do. It's affecting my life in a major way, in every way, all because of lies. For me doing my job, same thing I've been doing forever.
Your mother also told this committee about how she had to leave her own home for her safety and go into hiding after the FBI told her that it would not be safe for her there before January 6th and until the inauguration. Let's listen to a clip of her story in her own words.
Around the week of January 6th, the FBI informed me that I needed to leave my home for safety. And I left my home for safety around that time.
Understood. How long did you stay out? Did you, remain outside of your home for your own safety?
I stayed away from my home for approximately 2 months. It was horrible. I felt homeless. I felt, I can't believe this person has caused this much damage to me and my family. To have to leave my home that I've lived there for 21 years. And, I'm having to have my neighbors watch out for me, and I have to go and stay with somebody. It was hard. It was horrible.
And your conversation with the FBI about needing to leave your home for your own safety or perhaps recommending it, do you remember, was there a specific threat that prompted that, or was it the accumulation of threats that you had received?
What prompted it was getting ready to January 6th was about to come, and they did not want me to be at home because of all the threats and everything that I had gotten. They didn't want me to be there in fear of, the people were coming to my home, and I had a lot of that, so they didn't want me to be there. Just in case something happened, I asked, how long am I going to have to be at home? They said, at least until the inauguration.
Ms. Moss, I understand that people once showed up at your grandmother's house. Tell us about that experience.
I received a call from my grandmother. This woman is my everything. I've never even heard her or seen her cry ever in my life. And she called me screaming at the top of her lungs, like, Shay, Shay, oh my God, Shay, just freaking me out, saying that there were people at her home. And they, they knocked on the door, and of course she opened it and seeing who was there, who it was, and they just started pushing their way through, claiming that they were coming in to make a citizen's arrest. They needed to find me and my mom. They knew we were there. And she was just screaming and didn't know what to do, and I wasn't there, so I just felt so helpless and so horrible for her, and she was just screaming. I told her to close the door, don't open the door for anyone. And she's a 70 something, I won't say, year old woman, and she doesn't like having restrictions. She wants to answer the door. She likes to get her steps in, walking around the neighborhood. And I had to tell her, you can't do that. You have to be safe. You know, she would tell me that at night, people would just continuously send pizzas over and over to her home, you know, and they were expecting her to pay for these large amounts of pizzas. And she went through a lot that she didn't have to. And once again, it made me just feel so horrible.
In addition to the personal impact this experience has had on you and your family, one of the things that I find most disturbing is how these lies discourage longtime election workers from continuing to do this important work. Tell us, if you would, of the other election workers shown in that State Farm Arena video and their supervisors, how many are still election workers in Fulton County?
There is no permanent election worker or supervisor in that video that's still there.
And did you end up leaving your position as well?
Yes, I left.
Ms. Moss, I want to thank you for coming to speak with us and to thank you for your service to our democracy. What we have just played is a truly horrible and appalling sample, but just a sample of the things that were said about you and your mother following the election. I want to say how very sorry I think we all are for what you've gone through, and tragically, you're not alone. Other election workers around the country have also been the subject of lies and threats. No election worker should be subject to such heinous treatment just for doing their job. With your permission, I would like to give your mother the last word.
Yes.
We're just going to play the tape.
There is nowhere I feel safe. Nowhere. Do you know how it feels to have the President of the United States to target you? The President of the United States is supposed to represent every American, not to target one. But he targeted me, Lady Ruby, a small business owner, a mother, a proud American citizen who stand up to help Fulton County run an election in the middle of the pandemic.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. Thank you, Ms. Freeman, or as America now knows her, Lady Ruby, for your service to Fulton County, Georgia, our country, and our democracy. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Thank you, Mr. Schiff. Ms. Moss?
Yes, sir.
I want to thank you for sharing with us the very troubling story of what you and your mother experienced. The harassment of election workers like you simply for doing your duty as public servants poses a threat to our democratic process. Your testimony is an important contribution to the work of our committee and serves as a reminder to all of us that the safety of local election officials is vital to ensuring that our elections are always free and fair. I want to thank our witness for joining us today. The members of the Select Committee may have additional questions for today's witness, and we ask that you respond expeditiously in writing to those questions. Without objection, members will be permitted 10 business days to submit statements for the record, including opening remarks and additional questions for the witness. Without objection, the chair recognizes the gentleman from California, Mr. Schiff, for a closing statement.
For more than 200 years, our democracy has been distinguished by the peaceful transfer of power. When an American raises their right hand and takes the presidential oath of office, they are transformed from an ordinary citizen into the most powerful person in the world, the president. This is an awesome power to acquire. It is even more awesome when it is handed on peacefully. When George Washington relinquished the office of the presidency, it set a precedent that served as a beacon for other nations struggling against tyranny. When Ronald Reagan described it as a kind of miracle in the eyes of the world, he was exactly right. Other countries use violence to seize and hold power, but not in the United States. not in America. When Donald Trump used the power of the presidency to try to stay in office after losing the election to Joe Biden, he broke that sacred and centuries-old covenant. Whether his actions were criminal will ultimately be for others to decide. But what he did was, without a doubt, unconstitutional. It was unpatriotic, and it was fundamentally un-American. And when he used the power of his presidency to put the enormous pressure on state, local, and local elections officials and his own vice president, it became downright dangerous. On January 6th, that pressure became deadly. Ruby Freeman said the president is supposed to protect every American, not target them. And she is right. If the most powerful person in the world can bring the full weight of the presidency down on an ordinary citizen who is merely doing her job with a lie as big and heavy as a mountain, who among us is safe? None of us is. None of us. In city councils and town councils, on school boards and election boards, from the Congress to the courts, dedicated public servants are leaving their posts because of death threats to them and to their families. This is not who we are. It must not become who we are. Our democracy held because courageous people like those you heard from today put their oath to the Constitution above their loyalty to one man or to one party. The system held, but barely, and the question remains, will it hold again? If we are able to communicate anything during these hearings, I hope it is this. We have been blessed beyond measure to live in the world's greatest democracy. That is a legacy to be proud of and to cherish, but it is not one to be taken for granted. That we have lived in a democracy for more than 200 years does not mean we shall do so tomorrow. We must reject violence. We must embrace our Constitution with the reverence it deserves, take our oath of office and duties as citizens seriously, informed by the knowledge of right and wrong, and armed with no more than the power of our ideas and the truth, carry on this venerable experiment in self-governance. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I yield back.
Without objection, the chair recognizes the gentlewoman from Wyoming, Ms. Cheney, for a closing statement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Lady Ruby and Shay, thank you for your courage. Thank you for your strength. Thank you for being here today. It means so much for everyone to hear your story, so thank you for that. We have had tremendous testimony today. We've been reminded that we're a nation of laws, and we've been reminded by you and by Speaker Bowers and Secretary of State Raffensperger, Mr. Sterling, that our institutions don't defend themselves. Individuals do that. And we've reminded that it takes public servants. It takes people who've made a commitment to our system to defend our system. We also have been reminded what it means to take an oath under God to the Constitution, what it means to defend the Constitution. And we were reminded by Speaker Bowers that our Constitution is indeed a divinely inspired document. And so it's been an honor to spend time with you and with our previous witnesses here today. To date, more than 30 witnesses called before this committee have not done what you've done, but have invoked their Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. Roger Stone took the Fifth, General Michael Flynn took the Fifth, John Eastman took the Fifth. Others, like Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro, simply refused to comply with lawful subpoenas, and they have been indicted. Mark Meadows has hidden behind President Trump's claims of executive privilege and immunity from subpoenas. We're engaged now in litigation with Mr. Meadows. The American people in our hearings have heard from Bill Barr, Jeff Rosen, Richard Donahue, and many others who stood up and did what is right. And they will hear more of that testimony soon. But the American people have not yet heard from Mr. Trump's former White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. Our committee is certain that Donald Trump does not want Mr. Cipollone to testify here. Indeed, our evidence shows that Mr. Cipollone and his office tried to do what was right. They tried to stop a number of President Trump's plans for January 6th. Today and in our coming hearings, you will hear testimony from other Trump White House staff explaining what Mr. Cipollone said and did, including on January 6th. But we think the American people deserve to hear from Mr. Cipollone personally. He should appear before this committee, and we are working to secure his testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
People answer the call to public service in such different ways. Some run for office. Some volunteer to make sure their neighbors can get to their voting locations. Some work at polling sites to help Election Day go smoothly. Some look into problems to guarantee our elections are secure and accurate, just to name a few. As I mentioned at the start of this hearing, when we talk about our democratic institutions, we're talking about these individuals and many others who do these jobs across the country. They represent the backbone of our democracy at its most important moments, when the citizens cast their votes and when those votes are counted. We've heard the stories of their courage. They've earned the thanks of a grateful nation. But for Donald Trump, these witnesses and others like them were another roadblock to his attempt to cling to power. On Thursday, we'll hear about another part of that scheme, his attempt to corrupt the country's top law enforcement body, the Justice Department, to support his attempt to overturn the election. Just as we heard today that Donald Trump was deeply involved in a scheme to pressure state officials to overturn the election results, we will hear on Thursday that Donald Trump was also the driving force behind the effort to corrupt the Justice Department. Listen to this clip from the former acting Attorney General, Richard Donahue.
The president said, suppose I do this, suppose I replace him, Jeff Rosen, with him, Jeff Clark. What do you do? And I said, sir, I would resign immediately. There is no way I'm serving 1 minute under this guy, Jeff Clark.
You'll hear from Mr. Donahue in person on Thursday as my colleague, Mr. Kinzinger, presents details about this plan. The chair requests those in the hearing room remain seated until the Capitol Police have escorted members from the room. Without objection, the committee stands adjourned.